Hello, folks, and welcome to the March 29th edition of the World Labor Hour here at WEFT Champaign. We're broadcasting on the FM airways at 90.1 FM frequency, and we're streaming on the web at weft.org. And the views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, the associates, the station manager, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. They're simply our opinions. So here's Gus with some of the underwriters for this week's show.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employee Organization Union, the GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
We're proud to have the GEO and the rest of our underwriters, all of our underwriters here at WEFT, and especially those that support the World Labor Hour here. This is Bob Pelesny sitting in as the host this week. I'm also going to be joined by Gus Wood and Bill Gorell, one of the co-founders of the World Labor Hour here. What, some maybe 15 years ago, Bill? Something like that?
About 20.
20 years ago.
Wow.
So,
small, I think.
Yeah, wonderful. And so we're going to bring you a variety of news stories, labor-related news stories and opinions and stuff like that today. Have a couple public service announcements for you about halfway past the hour. And so I think we're going to let Gus kick it off this week with a news story.
All right. We got a lot going on this past week. There's been a lot of activity on the economic sector. One of the biggest stories that a lot of people aren't talking about is that there was a massive announcement of U.S. layoffs in this idea of an economic slowdown. U.S. corporations announced thousands or hundreds of thousands of layoffs in the weeks amid of plant closures. U.S. Steel announced 2,080 layoffs at its Granite City Works in Illinois. Hmm. The Pittsburgh-based steelmaker plans to lay off over 4,500 employees nationwide, including 1,800 workers in Alabama. Job cuts are also planned in Minnesota and Texas. That same day, steelmaker Worthington Industries of Columbus, Ohio announced plans to lay off 555 employees nationwide. Of these, 310 are to lose their jobs as a result of a closure of a plant. On Thursday, Ohio-based Republic Steel announced 200 layoffs at its Lorain, Ohio plant. The steel company said the layoffs were a response to a fall in demand stemming from the drop in oil prices and appreciation of the dollar, which have led to a reduction in international orders. Mm-hmm. And also on Wednesday, areas of labor, H.J. Hines announced plans to buy Kraft Foods Group in at a $36.6 billion deal that, according to one analyst, could lead to 5,000 job cuts, affecting nearly one quarter of Kraft's North American workforce. And we know that how that affects us here in Champaign. So
yeah. I talked to somebody at the Kraft plant this week, and they were hoping that it would have little or no effect on their plant because they are one of the, or maybe the biggest food production plant in the world, and they're thinking that they'll be closing some of the less efficient lines at other plants and stuff, and so maybe it will actually help them here locally. But
well, I know they spent a whole bunch of money on concrete out there last year,
building that new warehouse area down there south of the Kraft plant. Yeah,
wow, man, I had a 16-hour day on that once, and Yeah. It's just ridiculous. But, yeah, that's supposed to be, that is their flag, the company's flagship plant.
Right.
And
right.
Did this person say anything about, union organizing there?
No, we had those guests on about a year ago or whatnot, and I think that's kind of on the back burner these days. I think, partially with that new warehouse opening up and stuff, there's been a lot of upheaval in jobs over there, and, people are getting moved around to different departments and stuff, so, but no, I don't know where we're at if that's union push is still continuing out there at the craft plant or not.
Yeah, and also I haven't heard anything about truck bumper factory.
Guardian.
Yeah.
Well,
why
do
they call that
Flex Engage?
Yeah. That's always weird. Why do they call that Guardian West? It's like on the east side of town, but
I don't know. It's on Guardian Drive out there too, you know.
So, yeah. But it's right next to the Iron Workers Hall too.
Yeah.
On Butso Drive.
Butso, yeah.
Boy,
yeah.
Poured a lot of concrete out there too.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I know there's been a lot of layoffs in the oil industry too, yeah. You know, and not so much in the refining area yet, but in the drilling areas and stuff in Texas, there's been a lot of layoffs because of the drop in oil prices.
Speaking of refining, what's happened with that strike? I haven't.
Oh, they settled that about 2 weeks ago.
Wow.
And mainly over the issues of the safety in the plants and working hours and stuff like that. I think the companies have agreed to put together some type of arbitrating unit that will talk with the workers and determine the safest way to run these plants regarding hours worked and stuff like that, you know. Yeah. Keep them from working too many hours per day and per week and stuff like that.
Well, I understand that.
Still. You know, all this stuff going on with these different plants shutting down. You got one plant shutting down 200, another shutting down 500. Right. You know, and this is amidst one of the worst unemployment records in U.S. history. I mean, unemployment pay is at its lowest level in U.S. history at this point. And now you have these layoffs that are starting to pile up across the country now. You know, this is going to become a very tough situation. And plus the fact that a lot of these layoffs, usually when these plants close, they do not reopen later. They move
right,
overseas.
Right.
So, I mean, so these people who have a particular type of skill now have to abandon that skill to go into low skill or no skill work. That right. is going to pay them a lot less and have and to take away their chance of a livable wage. You know?
Yeah, they always send them to junior college to learn about computers too.
Yeah. Speaking of some of our jobs moving out of the country here, story out of Mexico's Baja California. Mm. More than 50,000 Mexican farm workers are striking in Baja California. Workers there they work at large export-oriented farms in the Mexican border state, and they've led to a week of protests over low pay, abuses, and poor conditions. It threatens a harvest that supplies millions of dollars worth of tomatoes, strawberries, and other crops to the United States. The strikers have been burning tires and tossing rocks at vehicles. Hundreds of farm workers have blocked the Trans-Peninsular Highway, Baja's main north-south highway, on and off throughout the week, and like I say, as many as 50,000 have been on strike statewide as of Tuesday. The demonstrators are demanding health care, overtime pay, days off, water. You know, that would be, you would think, an essential thing for people working in the farm fields and stuff.
Mm-hmm. We have to have it in our contracts.
Yeah. You do?
Yeah.
Laborers?
Yeah, it's in
water.
Yeah, all the trades have water in their contracts. Yeah. It's like this time of year, they don't have to provide cold water, ice water. That's true. You'd think that's just awful.
They're also striking over breaks, and they want to end to arbitrary firings and abuse, especially sexual abuse by the field bosses. And they want wages to be raised to about $20 a day. Says currently most of these farm workers earn $8 a day for labor spent stooped over the crops in huge hothouse farms just south of Ensenada. Many of the workers are migrants from southern Mexican states like Guerrero and Oaxaca. Mm-hmm. And they said it echoes the actions of the farm workers here in the United States 40 years ago. Talking to one of the farm workers, he says, we all saw it was something normal for them, for the farm owners to suspend people from work for 3 or 4 days or fire them without severance, for demanding respect for our rights, for demanding overtime or days off. This is Jose Ignacio Garcia. He's a 19-year-old. He's worked in the fields of Baja since he was 12 years old, you know.
Wow.
And that's what he says. We get paid. We work more than 10 hours a day for 100 pesos. That's about $7. That doesn't even buy the minimum necessities we need to live and to support a family. And as is familiar throughout much of our labor history here, these people are pretty much forced to go buy everything through the company stores.
Oh, yeah.
So they're paying inflated prices for the necessities of food and whatnot that they need just to survive, you know. So it says demonstrations have exploded into rock-throwing scuffles with riot police and led to the arrest of about 200 protesters. Restaurants and shop owners in the San Quentin and other Baja towns are boarding up their businesses as more than 1,000 police and army soldiers have spread throughout the state. Baja California state government has used police armored vehicles to break up road blockades and warned that there will be no tolerance for those whose demonstrations act outside the law. So
wow.
This happening just south of our border there. And it is our food that they're exporting up here to us. Much of it, they say right now, is rotting in the fields. But terrible working conditions for these people for very, very minimal pay.
Yeah, well, and then beyond that, there's incredible environmental consequences of all this food moving all over the world all the time.
Herbicides.
And for ridiculous reasons. I don't know, something came up somewhere, like in England or something. They grow apples there, but they import them from Spain or something.
Really?
And I've heard of, like, chickens being sent from the United States to China to be processed and brought back. You know, really? And that's just completely ridiculous.
Some of our poultry processing plants in this country are some of the worst working conditions in the world, man.
Yeah.
You know, that's why they sometimes get these unregistered immigrants in here to handle those jobs, because they're so crappy.
Yeah, and they don't have to, like you said, the pay is so lousy, and anytime that there's any type of organizing around that, they're gonna bring in police repression, using armored vehicles to break up a strike for people who want water.
Right.
I mean, that's the kind of country we live in. That's the kind of country the support of this Western alliance system that was inherited and started by Bill Clinton and NAFTA and continues today. I mean, we're supporting this kind of behavior to use armored trucks to break up strikes for people demanding water and food.
Right.
It's the simple necessities to live as a human being.
Wow, it sounds like Soylent Green.
Yeah. Some of these people have been working 12-hour days for weeks on end without a day off and stuff like that. You know, it's just,
They get you ever see that scene in Soylent Green? They get it like the, big, payloaders, end loaders we use on construction jobs. They just go out in the street and scoop the people up.
Yeah.
There's a scene in there that discusses global warming in Soylent Green, a movie.
Yeah. When did Soylent Green come out? 1970?
I thought it was 73, maybe.
It was early.
Yeah. Back when people like Ted Cruz say there was an article written in Newsweek about, oh, the world's cooling. You know, they keep going back to that. Oh, nobody ever thought there'd be global warming, but I know there was an American that had it figured out in 1847, but I can't remember his name. And then there's some Swedish guy with an unpronounceable name that wrote about it in 1888 when he was real happy about it because he thought Sweden was too cold. And you know, then going on, and then there's this scene where Edward G. Robinson, they have a – you see, what's his name? The guy used to be president of the NRA.
Charlton Heston.
Yeah, Charlton Heston. Okay. He's a cop, and he's got this side security job for this rich family, and he actually scores some real food. Okay. Instead of just Soylent Green.
Yeah.
And so Edgar G. Robinson's his older roommate, you know, and this guy was probably like an adult in the early 70s, you know, they're fixing this food, and he gets out his old plates and everything out. He goes, you know, we used to have real food like this all the time before the climate change.
Yeah.
And I can't find that scene on YouTube, so I hope score up a recording.
That's a classic movie, man. It has so many themes that's still current today.
Got another news story there, guys?
We got tons of them, really. There's so much going on now. One of the biggest things that a lot of people are talking about are,
there's so much going on, But how come every time you turn on a news channel, it's the same stories over and over and over? And they say, well, we had to run this because we have so much time to fill. We're a 24-hour news channel. We have so much time to fill.
You know why they're like that now. We're not going to actually put the stories in that can have people thinking now. We're going to run the same propagandized garbage that's not going to really tell anything.
You know about the latest blonde girl that's missing and
Either blonde girl missing or something about the president not doing something, you know, some type of inflammatory thing against Obama or against black people or against workers, you know, calling all these different, using these different terms to say that workers aren't allowed to do something. And when they strike, that they're causing trouble, they're using violence, they're not peaceful people. That's the kind of stuff I see all day on CNN and whenever I turn those stations. It's pretty hilarious, actually, that they think that these things are actually accurate portrayals of what's happening in this country. So, to the stories though, one of the biggest things that they're not talking about are the Republican budget plan slashes the Medicare, Medicaid, and food stamps. Now, they're talking about Republican budget cuts, but they're not actually breaking down the actual numbers. See, this Republican controlled House of Representatives and Senate now, they're going on a blitzkrieg type attack on social services that are going to affect over 10 million elderly, poor, and sick Americans, predominantly African-American, Latino, working class, and poor people. The House voted on Friday 228 to 199 with 17 Republicans and all Democrats to vote against the budget, but the Senate voted 52 to 46 with two Republican presidential hopefuls, Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, breaking ranks because they wanted even deeper cuts than the ones that they're proposing. The budget resolutions now go to a conference committee to negotiate the comparatively minor differences between the House and Senate, with a final vote required by April 15th to meet the provisions of the 1974 Budget Act. The resolution is not subject to a presidential veto because it does not actually have the force of law, but sets down certain procedural limits on further congressional action on spending legislation. So what's happening here now is that you have a rogue Congress, Republican Congress now, that is trying to reinvigorate or resurrect Reagan-like cuts, and now they're setting up their pawns in the state government, like Bruce Rauner and other state governors to take support in this. So we're really seeing a resurrection of late 1970s, early 1980s neoliberal theory being reinvigorated for the 2015 time period. It's really scary stuff.
Well, I'm pretty upset about it because I have several friends that are on disability, you know, and I'm getting older too, so I'm having more friends on Social Security and Medicare and such, and I don't know. I'm really getting pretty worried about things. The same people are electing these people.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't understand it. I still don't know what's the matter with Kansas or rural Illinois for that matter. And this is, people think about north, south, and conservative, liberal. It's urban, rural. That's the way this country is divided. Yeah. It's not.
Yep. Yep.
You know, you go to, Atlanta. Mm-hmm. I'm sure Atlanta has its very hip enclaves. Not everybody there is Newt Gingrich. Yeah. You know, who, by the way, is from Ohio originally.
Yeah.
But talk about carpetbagger.
Oh, really? Well, now we got Ted Cruz, like you mentioned. You know, here's the guy that was shutting down the government. Now he says he wants to run for president, you know? Does that make sense, you know?
Yeah, that is kind of a good joke. And all these Republicans hate Washington, D.C., but they all want to go there.
Yeah. And I'm just finding out this week that he's Canadian.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I just saw a quote in 2012. He said something about Barack Obama shouldn't be president, you know? Yeah. And now he's saying, oh, yeah, but my mother's American.
My mother's American, yeah. Yeah. But he was born in Canada.
Proven born in Canada. He was saying Barack Obama shouldn't be eligible to be president just because his dad was from Kenya.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I guess, okay, your dad's from Cuba. That's closer, you know, and not quite as dark. Man.
I'm sorry. No, I
was going to talk briefly about a news story here about our buddy Rauner again, you know. Ooh. Labor union.
And Rauner!
Yeah.
There he is.
Labor unions won an initial victory this week in the effort to block Governor Bruce Rauner's attempt to withhold fees that non-members pay in exchange for collective bargaining. Mm-hmm. A federal judge ruled Monday that the matter should be settled in state court. Unions sued this month to halt an executive order Rauner issued that stopped the fair share fees from being sent to them, asking a St. Clair County judge to free up the money while the legal process plays out. Rauner attempted to have the matter moved to a federal court, but U.S. District Judge Stacey Yandel ruled that the suit deals with questions regarding Illinois law and should be debated in state court. So it says Rauner has made it a top priority to do away with the fees, arguing that they violate free speech and that workers should not have to support unions they don't want to belong to. So,
where was it? Indiana, they tried this. It was unconstitutional in Indiana because that the unions are providing a service to these people, even if they're not members of the union. Yeah. And, thus taking away the agency fees would be a form of theft of service.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, the good thing is that there are people who are, you know, trying to fight this both at the state level and on the ground level. So they actually went to Springfield. Over 2,000 people met Rauner when he was giving a speech at the Capitol in Springfield, and they protested during the speech and outside of the building as well. So you got a whole bunch of groups getting together that are, you know, actually working towards fighting Rauner on this. So a lot of stuff is going on at this point now where he has made so many enemies from his ridiculous and illogical arguments and cuts that would totally destroy the state of Illinois for years to come. That there's the, I don't see him being successful in this if we continue to stay strong and keep fighting. I really don't.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. I mean, he's probably the best thing that's happened to, labor in Illinois and other progressive movements in 12 years or something
like that. Yeah. Since the, nah, longer than that, decades at this point. I mean,
to get the workers to unite together and stand up together and to fight against.
Well, it's been since about 1996.
Yeah.
I remember, cause I still have the flyers on my wall for, labor lobby days that, included thousands of people.
Yeah.
Up to 15,000 people, I believe it was in 96. I got the photographs.
Yeah.
To prove it.
Yeah, you've been to Springfield several times taking photographs for various organizations. And
I got one more bizarre story coming out that just came out yesterday. A 32-year-old Long Island woman was driving home one evening when the NYPD seized her BMW because they alleged that she was high on marijuana, though none was found in her car. And when she became emotional in the station, she was sedated and removed to a Harlem hospital where she was kept for 8 days. After being told she was delusional and bipolar, she was forced to take lithium and lorazepam or whatever that is, as well as endure group therapy and sedative injections. So what happened was she told the officers that she is working and that she, you know, she was trying to explain that she has a job and things like that. And that she mentioned that, you know, I'm a former banker and they just called her bipolar and threw her into an asylum.
Yeah. Lorazepam's, I think it's also called Ativan.
Yeah.
It's a fairly powerful drug. I mean, if you come in, you're freaking out on acid or something, they get it out. And then if that doesn't work, then the Thorazine.
Yeah, these police officers are off the chain. Now, luckily, she has a suit where she's going to sue the city of New York for this, but this is getting ridiculous at this point.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
She wasn't. How dangerous does she look? All right, sorry folks. On Thursday, 17-year-old Christiana Coignard was shot dead by three police officers in the lobby of the Longview Police Department. This is in Texas.
Wow.
Police say the girl was, quote, brandishing a weapon before she was shot four times. The three officers who have not been identified have been placed on leave. The investigation of Coignard's death is now being handled by the Texas Rangers. Officials could not, quote, confirm the type of weapon Coignard brandished at the officers.
Huh.
You know, I mean, you're in the so lobby, already in the lobby of a police station. What, did she grab a pencil or a pen or something?
A ruler, maybe.
You know, but see, she
was a stapler.
Yeah, what happened was, she was somebody who, she was mentally ill.
Okay.
And, can't remember how the cops got involved. Here's her grandmother. She was living with her grandmother. But I mean, you know, it's just crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Yep. Why don't we go to a quick musical break here, and we'll be right back with some more labor-related news and commentary here at the World Labor Hour on WEFT Champaign.
What? ago. Illegal business controls America.
What were we listening to there, guys?
That was KRS-One, the legend in hip hop, and his song "Illegal Business," talking about how pharmaceuticals are doing the exact same thing as illegal sales of crack and cocaine on the streets, making billions of dollars off of the health and destruction of people in this country. You know, just I mean, talk stuff that he mentioned back in the late '80s that are still resonating today. KRS-One was just so ahead of his time in hip hop.
It was the Advent Kids, you know, like KRS. But what's KRS stand for? Do you know that? Or? Huh? What's KRS stand for?
I just had it too.
I'm sorry.
No. yeah, it's been a long day. Already?
Already?
Already, yeah.
I'll give us a couple of public service announcements here. I want to remind folks that 2 o'clock today you can tune in to our friend Neil Parthon, fellow worker, with his Not Another Sports Show on WRFU. What is that, 104.5?
I don't know. But
since they raised their tower now, they're still LP low power, but you can pick them up pretty much around the Champaign-Urbana area these days. And
Also, too, did they ever start streaming?
No, I don't think so. But Neil makes his show available. Check it out.
Oh, like either
on podcast and, you know.
Oh, yeah. I think he's on iTunes, isn't he?
iTunes, yes. And also, always highly recommended, tune into Labor's View TV on cable channel 6. That's on Sundays, every Sunday at 4 p.m. Normal host of this show, David Johnson, does a great job of putting that out on the Urbana Public TV channel, cable channel 6, local Comcast.
Oh, and by the way, if you're geographically challenged like I am, they do have a YouTube channel.
UPTV?
Yeah.
Yes. Mm. And they show a lot of WEFT shows on there. Prairie Monk gets shown on there. And West Sessions gets repeated on there once a week and stuff. They do a lot of good broadcasting, video
casting.
What's
Prairie Monk do on there? Does he do like little...
His show from Sunday?
Like in the studio here? Yeah. Or, okay, because he's like in the environmental thing and all right. This history around here. Man, yeah, we need to get tapped into him for some documentaries.
Oh, yeah.
He's got a WEFT show on Sunday mornings at 11 o'clock, right?
Yeah. And he's incredibly knowledgeable of the history of this area, especially
railroads and stuff.
Yeah,
and
buildings.
I mean,
you can see his place next door to WEFT.
It's like going through a museum over there. Yeah. You know, and that gets repeated on the UPTV cable channel 6. You know?
Well, they bring cameras in the studio and just set them
up. Yeah, every week, I think so. Almost every week. Yeah. So yeah, it's a good show. And also we should mention that tomorrow kicks off the WEFT Spring Pledge Drive. So stay tuned for that. You know, I'm sure we'll be hitting that harder next week, but I'll just give you all a little advance warning that starting tomorrow on Women Making Waves, we're going to kick off the pledge drive. So,
nice. Well, what are those women making waves about?
That's women.
I haven't listened to that show for a while.
Music for women, by women, about women. It's a lesbian feminist program. Doesn't have to be, you know, lesbian and feminist, but music by women, for women, about women. So,
all right. Cool.
Yeah, it's a good program as well.
And just to back up to pronounce, make sure I pronounce his name right. So, you know, it's Krishna. So that's why it's KRS is Krishna.
Oh yeah, Krishna. Yeah. Huh? Yeah. That's interesting in itself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, does he hang around airports and hand out literature? Or?
Well, he puts it on beat. So yeah. That,
there
he,
you go.
He considers himself a professor. So yeah.
Wow.
Cool.
Yeah.
We got another news story?
Yeah, let's the main topic we want to get into today to discuss is that of course everybody now hopefully is, if you're not aware, there's a major runoff election going on in Chicago between Chuy Garcia and Rahm Emanuel. Chuy Garcia came in and just really kind of shocked the country really. This is a national story at this point by challenging Rahm Emanuel to take it to a runoff, because a lot of people had picked Emanuel to just take the election easily. But the question that we want to ask is, who is Chuy Garcia, and that he has done some amazing, amazing community work. The stuff he's doing currently with the Fight for 15 campaign is exemplary, and he's showing that he wants to make a change, but we still need to make sure that we are critical of the people that we choose to vote for. We're doing a lot of voter campaigning and voter education now, especially in the Champaign Urbana area where we have elections coming as well very soon. So one of the things that we want to make sure we tell the young people and other folks who are getting ready to start voting is they need to research their candidates. And one of the things that we've been looking at in terms of Chuy Garcia is that he does a lot of great things in terms of community work and looking at helping in terms of injustice and racial, sexual, gender discrimination, things like that. But he has kind of a controversial history on labor. There was a piece that was recently written that looks at the history of his support for layoffs and budget cuts when he was Cook County Commissioner.
Support for layoffs?
Yes. Just giving some background here. He's relying on support from the Chicago Teachers Union and Large Service Employees Union, SEIU, one of our partners in labor units. He's relying on them for his campaign to unseat Emanuel, even though he does have a record of supporting layoffs and pension cuts. Emanuel, who was a national political power broker who was unexpectedly forced in April 7th in a runoff, is despised amongst union activists for his budget cuts and layoffs. But Garcia, when he was Cook County Commissioner, has boasted of an agenda that did involve layoffs. And to quote him, he said, "I believe that we demonstrate through our actions that we can live within our means." Then there's the closing of 49 schools, which cost jobs and disrupted thousands of children's lives. Garcia criticized Emanuel for that move, but he will not promise to reopen the schools when asked about it. Garcia has also systematically avoided any discussion on how to increase city revenues or specifying budget cuts. While Garcia did endorse a financial transaction tax, his aides quickly added that the candidate merely supported such a measure as national policy, but not as a strategy to make Chicago's financial powerhouses pay their share to cover Chicago's looming $1 billion plus pension and other budget shortfalls. Garcia has promised to end the use of tax subsidies for businesses through the tax increment financing scheme that divers revenue away from schools and into a virtual slush fund controlled by the mayor. But he stopped short of saying he'd abolish the program altogether. And while Emanuel drew the fire of city employees by pushing through steep pension cuts, Garcia has served as floor leader for Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, who has a pension shredding plan of her own that would cut benefits, raise the retirement age, and force workers to pay more. Garcia told reporters that as mayor, he considers similar measures for municipal employees, but he talked to union leaders into going along with such cuts rather than simply ramming them through ROM style.
Oh, that make a lot of difference to my attitude about getting my cuts.
Yeah.
They weren't just rammed through; they were negotiating.
As long as they talk, we talk. As long as they talk to laid off. Yeah. As long as they talk to us and prepare us that we're gonna lay you off instead of actually just doing it, it's gonna be better for the workers. To quote him, "I do not support cutting benefits for current city employees until we have a dialogue and an agreement of the stakeholders, including organized labor." And that's an actual quote from Chuy. His fiscal plan states, "The city will always need to negotiate contracts and the landscape of city facilities will evolve. Marshaling the cooperation of stakeholders instead of the sweeping polarization of the incumbent has incited in 4 short years will be instrumental if the city is to have any hope of unwinding from its financial mess." Or in translation, Rom provoked struggles in a strike when he willed the budget acts, but they'll accept austerity from me. So Bill was saying, this is the very frightening thing here is that there's still going to be a looming decision made on the economic situation of this country. And again, although I feel as though Chuy Garcia is light years better than Rahm Emanuel, there's still this idea that just because you're negotiating our downfall doesn't negate the fact that it's still our downfall as workers of this country. It's something that we just have to be able to raise questions about our politicians who are running for office, and this idea of the Democratic Party, just because they have a somewhat more leftist version in the Democratic Party, they're still the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party has not been favorable to labor for quite some time now. And we have to address it the way it is actually being explicitly shown to us.
It's still a corporate political party.
Yeah.
At the same time, the billing trades councils or billing trades unions in Chicago were running ads on WCPT in supporting Rahm Emanuel.
Supporting Rahm Emanuel.
Yeah. But I imagine the billing trades look at him as somebody who'd be able to bring in a whole bunch of projects.
Yeah,
exactly. Town,
you know, I think I heard that Unite Here was supporting Rahm Emanuel as well.
Hotels.
You know, yeah. You know,
conventions.
Yeah.
Hey, Indiana, you're losing some conventions. They're welcome in Illinois.
Yeah, speaking
of
Indiana.
Along with your LGBT attendees.
Speaking of Indiana losing some conventions, Indiana Governor Mike Pence vigorously defended the state religious objections bill that he signed into law Thursday, as businesses and organizations, including the NCAA, pressed concerns that it could open the door to legalizing discrimination against gay people. The state became the first to enact such a change this year among about a dozen where such proposals have been introduced. Arkansas's governor said Thursday he supported a similar bill that's advancing in the state's legislature. The Washington-based Human Rights Campaign said Indiana lawmakers have sent a dangerous and discriminatory message. They basically said as long as your religion tells you to, it's okay to discriminate against people despite what the law says. So the Indianapolis-based NCAA, which is holding its men's basketball Final Four in the city next weekend, said in a statement it was concerned about the legislation and was examining how it might affect future events and its workforce. Another company, San Francisco-based Salesforce.com, their CEO, Mark Benioff, announced on Twitter that he was canceling all programs that require its customers and employees to travel to Indiana to face discrimination. So it's good to see some of these organizations and corporations and actually standing up, you know, against these policies.
Well, you know, and I mean, everybody's putting this into the LGBT. I might be skipping a letter there somewhere. I think one's been added recently. But, I mean, look at all the other sincerely held religious beliefs, such as, I don't know what, Mormons, they wouldn't allow African Americans in or to be preachers or whatever. I don't know what the Flying Spaghetti Monster is going to tell me about this, but I may have a sincerely held religious belief about not helping, serving Republicans from Indiana.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's,
yeah. It's getting to the point now where we have a lot, and I think that this is actually helping what the neoliberalists and the capitalists want, because they're dividing labor based on these political ideologies. I mean, there's no reason why labor should be so divided on Chuy Garcia versus Rahm Emanuel at this point. I mean, to be honest with you, labor shouldn't be supporting either one of them if we're talking about strictly on the background of their policies. You know, like I said, but we could be jumping the gun. I mean, Chuy Garcia has actually been doing things recently with the Fight for 15 that has been showing that maybe he has changed his stance. It's just that his recent quotes in the news and when people ask him questions have been very ambiguous as to how he feels about pension cuts and layoffs.
Right.
You know, this is scary stuff. And they're talking about him being this Harold Washington mayor in Chicago.
Yeah, he served with Harold Washington. Yeah, he was in the administration.
Yeah, let's do some history here, because people know me, know I'm very big on history. Yeah, and I know Harold Washington found himself hemmed up by a Republican governor and massive budget cuts in 1983 when Reagan's coming in. Right. So Harold Washington had to face this onslaught of Reaganomics. So Washington's austere budgets put him on a collision course with the Chicago Teachers Union, which went on strike against him twice. Huh. So Washington, with the support of Garcia, who was then an alderman, sought additional revenue by raising property taxes. And when Washington dies in 1987, what had been called a movement collapsed into a bitter faction fight. So here on the campaign trail, Garcia avoids that part of the Harold Washington story. Working class folk who stepped up in this campaign feel that Chicago need to be responsive to the neighborhoods and towards ordinary people. And we delivered, he said, after a general election forced a runoff vote. It may be the retooling of a Democratic coalition, maybe with a small D. but you can't be for the working class Chicago and hail the civic community of the commercial club of Chicago. So what's happening here is that Garcia, he wants it to have it both ways. He wants to use these populist themes to bring the unions and working class voters together to vote for him. Mm-hmm. But he's also signaling to the business elites that he would be a better manager of city finances than Emmanuel. So what he's doing is, this is a historical trend of mayors of big urban areas that you see happening, that this kind of political clientage thing that Martin Kilson talks about in his theory, that you want to use the working class people to rally votes, but your policies and your main constituency are going to possibly be the business elites, because they're the ones who are going to make a lot of big decisions in the economics of the city. So this is a problem that is, and it's not Garcia's issue. It's an issue of the system that he is placed in. Yep. You know, so he's trying to fight a very difficult struggle against different class systems at this point, and it's going to be very difficult for him to maintain that.
Well, you know, Samuel Gomper said that he wanted pure and simple unionism, where the unions rewarded their friends and punished their enemies. But what happens when you run out of friends? Yeah, well, public enemy. That looks good. Is it?
Oh yeah,
radio friendly.
Number 13.
Yeah,
that's I make sure I picked the radio the radio friendly version.
Yeah, you were talking about tax incremental financing districts, you know, and I think it's ironic we were mentioning Kraft earlier, and they used one of those TIF districts over there to help get that warehouse put in.
Well, and thank you for contributing to my income last year.
Yeah,
people and of Champaign.
Now they're turning around and asking the taxpayers to approve $150 million in bond referendums, right? To build a new central high school.
Yeah, well, yeah, not very central though.
No.
But also too, the big thing is this jail that, you know, they're trying to push forward to, this $32 million jail that's on the table as well.
Yeah.
You know that the historical trend of a jail or a prison is when they make it, they're going to fill it up.
It's like a military.
Exactly. You have to use it to pay the bills on it. So,
but they turn around and give these tax breaks to corporations like Kraft, that just got bought out, and their stock went up like $30 this week.
Oh man.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It went from like $60 to $90 just in 2 days.
Wow. Wow. Capitalism.
So, yeah.
My God, you own those pieces of paper?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. All right. Here we go. What is this? Public Enemy?
This is Public Enemy with Revolutionary Generation.
You know, Chuck D was a talk show host on the old Air America.
Here you go, right here on the World Labor Hour, WEFT Champaign.
A little respect. I would say she needs a lighter. Brother, for my mother like me has
We're coming back here to the World Labor Hour, and we got a couple more thoughts and stories we wanted to kind of wrap up with here this week. So going back to Gus.
Yeah, one of the big things that we have to address is that because of the rampant murder spree that the police have been on in the United States of America, a lot of people are pointing to the fact that some type of defense mechanism that they are stopping black on black crime, and that the reason why there's so much police killing blacks because there's so much black on black crime, which is first of all, the term black on black crime is a very racist statement. And the reason they use it is to racialize the term black with the term violence. And that you never actually hear people talk about white on white violence, which the statistics are showing is actually higher. And I'm going to go into a couple of those statistics in a minute. But the main thing I want to make sure that people realize that when you use the term black on black crime, it should not be used in the context of it shouldn't be used at all, because when people say it, they're equating violence to African American groups, and we know that is not the case, and we can't continue to defend these ideas. And one of the things I find to be very funny about is that there's black on black crime and stuff. I want somebody to go into a working class or poor black neighborhood and show me the factory where the guns are being made.
Nah. Yeah.
I mean, I really want to see that. I want to see where the guns are being made, because that's not happening, and it never has, is that the guns are actually being sold to these young people for a very cheap price by government officials and by white business privateers. One of the most brilliant movies that came out that people virtually ignored in 1993 on HBO was a movie called Strapped. And because it was a very low budget movie, it was made by Bill Duke, who was an actor himself, but decided to make this movie. And it is a scarring criticism on capitalism and how you have these outside forces that are mainly white majority that are selling guns and provoking gang violence in neighborhoods to make money off of this violence. And a lot of people don't like to talk about it, but if you have a chance to see that movie, it's on YouTube. And it's what you would call a hood movie from back during that time when they were making Men's Society and Boys in the Hood and things like that. But the underlying theme behind the movie is that you have these people coming in who are creating these violent conflicts amongst African American youth who are economically disadvantaged, and they're selling them these weapons and these drugs and just flooding the streets with this stuff. I mean, this stuff is everywhere, but nobody is talking about that at all.
Have you noticed how heroin's made a big comeback lately?
Yeah.
We do have some major foreign policy issues.
Oh yeah.
You know, that's something you can track historically, is where we're involved in underhanded ways through what drug is the most popular, whether it's cocaine or heroin. Oh, cocaine. Yeah, we're in South America this year.
Right.
You know, something like that.
Heroin comes from Afghanistan. Huh?
And here's how this stuff comes, man. I used to have a girlfriend who years before in the 70s dated a scion of the that big family in Cincinnati, the Mellon family. Okay. This guy had a different name. His mom married a Mellon, and they were running, cargo planes, those old World War II cargo planes from Colombia into the United States to sell cocaine. And this guy, when he turned 18, he inherited $70 million. I mean, he's just doing it for the fun of it, basically, in a lot of ways. And that's, I mean, you've heard of the Mellon Scaife guy. Okay, that was his family. That probably had one of his nephews or cousins.
Well, it was brought out years ago that the CIA was bringing drugs into Los Angeles and stuff to help stir up problems with the gangs and stuff in L.A.
And they made the movie about it, the Gary Webb movie that recently came out.
Yeah.
It wasn't very good, but the book is actually better, that talks about what Gary Webb exposed with the CIA.
Right.
But one of the craziest things, another great movie that if you get a chance to find it somewhere, called Bastards of the Party, it is about the actual history of the creation of the gangs, and the gangs for over two decades when they were first created were strictly about community building and protecting from police violence. And that's what they did until external forces came in the 1970s and introduced guns and drugs and put subversive figures in these gangs to start beefs with other neighborhoods. And that's when all that violence started. So this is something that was externally motivated. This wasn't black people actually deciding to start killing each other. This stuff was actually created by capitalists who wanted to make money off of the violence and drug war that they wanted to create. And this idea of gang stuff, look at these statistics here. Gang-related killings are referred to on the news, and they talk about, and it's exclusively a black problem. However, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, for the period of 1980 to 2008, a majority of 53.3% of gang homicides were committed by white offenders, and the majority of gang homicide victims, 56.5%, were white. And that's over 1980 to 2008, that period. Wow. So again, this idea that gang violence is a black problem in this country, these are United States statistics. What you have here is crimes committed by whites often are explained in the media as deviations of the individual. He was such a quiet man. The community is shocked. They are shocked, but have nothing to do with race. But crimes committed by blacks or Latinos are somehow attributed to race with little exception. Gangbangers from South Chicago have somehow become a symbol that black men are to be feared, and that there is not the same characterization of fear that could be attached to brutal murders committed by neo-Nazis or white nationalist leaguers, redeemers from the South.
Well, it's the same way with terrorism. Yeah. You're much more likely to be killed by a white Christian right-wing nut job terrorist than you are by a Muslim of any description within the United States.
Exactly.
Tom Hartman used to do this really good thing where we'd go over all of these white terrorist crimes that, you know, nobody hears about.
Criminalizing race. I mean, that's what we have going on here. So again, whenever somebody uses the term black on black crime, I ask these types of critical questions: is what do you mean by black on black crime? What is the binary? What is the distinction? And put it into context of why there is an African American who has to make the choice to take the life of another African American, and to not paint this as a generalized stereotype on the race of people, because it is something that is not true. It is not an accurate depiction of black life in this country. And the people using it in the media are criminalizing African Americans by doing this, and we have to call them out when they do it.
Wonderful. So, well, on that note, I think we're going to wrap up the World Labor Hour here at WEFT Champaign.